And so I decided I was going to try and earn £40,000 in a year. And that definitely didn't happen. I paid, bought four pairs of shoes in a McDonald's.
One guest, 10 songs, 10 reasons. Music was my first love.
My guest on this edition of Music Was My First Love made her name when in July through until September 2006, she landed in our Saturday night front living room as a contestant on the BBC talent competition, How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria? After winning the competition on December the 15th, 2006, she opened to rave reviews in the part of Maria Von Trapp in The Sound of Music in the West End on a six-month contract, which was extended until February 2008, followed by a UK tour of the production in 2009. But as you would expect, there's a lot more to my guest than just The Sound of Music, including a recurring role in 2020 on Casualty, a move into TV production, as well as an emotional fight to save her voice. I'm talking about Connie Fisher, and we'll hear from Connie after her first choice from Carole King.
You make me feel like a natural woman.
And it's a delight to say, Connie Fisher, welcome to Radio Glamorgan's Music Was My First Love.
Thank you so much. What an honour. I feel like I'm on Desert Island Discs.
Oh, no, we're better than that, really. We just haven't been going as long.
Fantastic. I'm excited. This actually was recommended to me by one of my favourite people, Jamie Bolsh.
Yeah, who was a guest, yeah.
Who was a guest, and I made a TV programme with him years and years ago, and we happened to win, it sounds like I'm name dropping, but we happened to win a BAFTA for this show, and I got to know him so well on that journey that I trust him so implicitly. So if he says to me, Con, you've got to do this, then I do it.
Well, can I tell you, thanks to Jamie, we've got two guests in this current series because of him. You're one and Colin Jackson is the other, so he comes with a nice little black book. Tell me about your first choice from the great Carole King.
Oh, Carole King has always been just a voice that I've grown up with. You know, as you're growing up, I have twins now, and they're growing up with very different voices. But Carole King was always on our radio, on our wireless, as my mum used to say. And when I was on the show, we had to choose our favourite songs to sing. And that is pretty tricky because you know your own voice, but you also know that the audience wasn't a musical theatre audience. It was more of a pop audience, and it was of an age. And I thought, right, what will appeal to them, and what do I love? What do we have in common? And Natural Woman, I had sung for years and years, but never publicly. I'd never sung it out loud, really, in front of people, until I went to the routine for the show, and I said, I want to sing Natural Woman on the first show. I sang it for the first time in front of people, and they were like, yes, this is your opener. And I remember singing down the barrel of the camera thinking, this show could change my life. And I sang it, and it did.
And the song did. You grew up a child of the army, with your dad being a major in the Royal Corps of Signals, but home life, was there, you mentioned Carole King, but was there a lot of music growing up?
Yes, there was. Neither of my parents were particularly musical, but for some reason, I don't know how it happened, but one day we had in school an Easter parade, an Easter kind of concert, and my nan said, you should sing Roll Out the Barrel, I think she said. So I think I might have done something like that. And I said to my friend, let's sing Chim Chimney from Mary Poppins, probably because it's the only film that I had seen. And we got up on stage and I can't even remember quite what I'm sure we sang from Mary Poppins. She definitely had a top hat and tails. Well, I had a top hat and tails. She'd lost a top hat. I remember that much. And I remember thinking, oh, you've let my team down. So we did this. We did this performance. And I thought, I care about this. You know, I care too much about this, seemingly. And I was in tune and I was all right. And they clapped at the end and I got the bug. And then there was an opportunity to sing in the primary school, Eisteddfod, and I was all right, actually. And they said, would you like to sing, you know, for the cilch, as they call it? Mm. And so I did. And it grew from there. I just think I loved it from the get-go. And Nana Dot was the one with a voice. And because my dad was away a lot, I stayed with my nan and my gramp, and I grew up on a farm in Pembrokeshire. And I just had a whole lot of space to sing. You know, my nan would sing with me, and we'd just go, quite literally, go and sing The Hills Are Alive, because we lived on a mountain farm.
I was just thinking, yeah, very open space, very Sound of Music.
Yeah. I actually joked once that I was like Maria and kind of did the opening scene, and everyone was laughing, but I thought one day, no, maybe I could do that. Mm. And a girl from Pembrokeshire going to drama school, where I lived, was unusual. So I had this dream, and then it happened. So I don't know. I don't really know where it all started. I think it started with my nan, with the school concert, and grew from there.
You moved to Pembrokeshire at the age of 4. I hate to put you on the spot, but do you consider yourself Welsh?
Yeah, of course. I speak Welsh. I grew up in Wales and went to Welsh school. So I don't really think being Welsh is being born in Wales. I think it's where you feel is home for you. And if you speak the language, brilliant. That's a great asset. What a beautiful language we have. Mm. But hey, I've got, you know, the opportunity to have an Irish passport too. So that's kind of handy. But I was, as they call a pad brat, they call them. I was, I don't know why they call them that, but I grew up on an army pad, I guess. But I don't remember any of that. I only ever remember growing up in Wales and lush green hills and singing in them. So I consider myself Welsh through and through.
Your second choice, Connie, is from, I think... and you might say I'm wrong, but I think she's incredibly underrated, Doris Day. I presume a heroine of yours?
Not really. Doris Day, I know, was one of my nan's favourites, so I guess that's why I chose her. But it was only a name to me until I went to drama school. And then when you get to drama school, and I went to Mountview in North London, they expect you to know your voice and what to sing. And I just took to classic book, as they call it, so kind of pre-50s, pre-contemporary musical theatre, so anything classic or old school films, as my nan would say, and I love singing them. So yeah, Doris Day was one of those voices, pretty timeless, and I wanted to be one of those timeless voices. And I sang Secret Love. When you've got a record deal, they ask you what you want to sing. So, you need to know your voice. So I basically pulled out my whole drama school repertoire and said, I'll sing Doris Day. And they called it Secret Love because it was my title track of my second album.
And why I'm so in love with you.
At what stage did you or people around you realise that you had this gift from God, this beautiful voice?
Gosh, I'm not sure when anyone said I was any good at singing. I can't remember that moment, but I do remember singing in these concerts with my nan sort of saying, oh, you know, you should sing these old wartime songs. And we had this cassette and she'd put it on. And I just prayed that that cassette would never break because I loved it so much. And they were just all, you know, following my father's footsteps was one of the songs, and I absolutely loved singing that song. Kind of, again, like Doris, a bit of timeless, amazing music that I just, you know, Doris Day's voice there. I mean, just, I just love it. It's incredible because it's so powerful. And what she was singing about, you know, she was singing about her secret love because she apparently, by all accounts, she was part, you know, she was a lesbian and she was hiding this secret love. And I just find that incredibly powerful. And you can hear that emotion in her voice. And I think from a young age, people could hear an emotion in my voice. And that's what they connected to. It wasn't really a good voice. It was an okay voice, but I connected with the music. And I think that's why people felt that they liked my singing. I think that's the only reason, because I got emotional.
You went to drama school, and during your teenage years, you remember the Haverford West Operatic Society. Was it an enjoyable experience?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. I remember driving myself to that audition. And of course, you know, these operatic societies, they don't like newbies. I don't know why I was so keen, but I heard they were auditioning for Pirates of Penzance, and I knew I needed some experience to get better at performance on stage. And It's a sad story, but my grandfather was dying at the time, and I needed a distraction really from that sadness, because he had Parkinson's and he was struggling, and my mum was caring for him brilliantly. And I think I was on a gap year from school, before drama school, because I didn't get in initially. My first punt at drama school, I was offered a place but not a scholarship. And I couldn't afford that, and my parents couldn't afford that. And so I decided I was going to try and earn £40,000 in a year. And that definitely didn't happen. I paid, bought four pairs of shoes in a McDonald's. And so I joined the Haverford West Operatic Society to get more experience, to think, right, I've got to get better at this and entertaining audiences and throwing myself in at the deep end. So I turned up at Narberth at this audition, and incredibly, I got it. And it had a top F in it, like the above top C, like a ridiculously high, only dogs can hear kind of note. And I squeaked it out and I got the part. So that was great. And I had a wonderful time. It was the only performance I did with, the only show I did with them, because then, hey, who knew? I got a scholarship to drama school and then went. So it must have paid off, and it was a great experience.
Well, in 2002, at the age of 19, you won a scholarship to the National Eisteddfod Songs from the Shows competition and the Milford and West Wales Mercury Talent competition. That must have been a massive break.
I love that, yeah. No, God, that's, you made it sound fantastic.
Well, yeah.
If anybody went to the Pill Social Centre, my friend Josh with me, I was singing like karaoke with a PA system my dad bought me, which was wonderful. But I think it conked out halfway through. So you've made it sound glamorous, but and the scholarship, I think that was given after I'd sung it. So it was like, you've sung, oh, she was all right. Give her some money. These things sound good on paper, don't they? Mm. But to be honest with you, just those accolades were a massive boost. In reality, they were enormous graft. And that's what every performer needs. They need to go to the social centre down in Milford and sing. I didn't think I'd win. I wasn't quite up against a drag queen, but basically I was up against a whole lot of cabaret. And I did not think my little voice would win that show. And some magicians, actually. I remember this magician, he should have won. But thankfully I did. And to me, that was an enormous confidence boost.
We've had over 90 guests in six series of Music Was My First Love. And every now and again, I get this list of songs through, and there's always one on there that's a little bit left field, shall we say. And your next right. choice is something I wouldn't really have expected to see on your list. So tell me about Jump Around from House of Pain.
Oh, I have to say, this is one of my favourite songs in the world. And now I have kids. Yeah. I went to one of those bouncy castle birthday parties on the weekend. And I think they're going to become a sort of a more frequent thing, aren't they, birthday parties, because they're only turning three in January and they've not even gone to school yet. So I expect to hear this song a lot more. And the kids went wild. This song came on. I'm sure they're hopefully playing the radio edit, because I think there's some kind of naughty words in it. But this, I remember this from Mrs. Doubtfire, and I loved it. Just absolutely, is it Mrs. Doubtfire? Am I making that up?
I'm sure this might be
Mrs. Doubtfire. Either way, it's come into my life as a teenager. I haven't stopped jumping around since. My kids love it. It's their favourite song. And they've got this Peppa Pig trampoline, this tiny trampoline in the house. And they often say to me, Mummy, play Jump Around, House of Pain. And they jump around, favourite song ever. They played it at my wedding and the place went nuts.
Oh, your wedding and your house must be a madhouse, both of them at times.
Honestly, you've got to be mad to be a performer, right?
That's true. I came to get down, I came to get down. So get out your seat and jump around, jump around.
Jump around, jump around. You have made my day.
I was just going to say, I don't know.
Andrew, you've made...
I don't know what the audience were listening
You've
to.
You've made my day.
I was listening to House of Pain featuring Connie Fisher. Actually, that's what I had in my ears. Connie Fisher.
Oh! I was jumping around.
I can hear.
At the best time. They're going to play that at my funeral. I absolutely love it. Love it.
Tell me about your time at Mount View Academy of Theatre Arts, which, due to a Dance for Drama Award, am I right in saying was fully government-funded?
I absolutely loved drama school. It was incredible. It wasn't a university. It was before UCAS and all of that. So it was tricky because I couldn't have afforded to go there. My parents had split at that point, and it is means-tested. And I remember that, you know, being a terrible tragedy in our lives, like my parents splitting. But actually, you know, in terms of me being able to be considered for the scholarship, it turned out to be a blessing. And so I went to drama school, and yeah, it was tough. But do you know what prepared me was the Eisteddfods. I can't tell you enough how the Eisteddfod I helped me to prepare as a performer. And yeah, I love drama school, super competitive. You know, I can't say you make friends in drama school because you are constantly competing every single day to be noticed and to, you know, embetterize yourself. And everyone's in competition, but I did make some friends. My biggest friend from drama school was a guy who dropped out, and he was the only guy who dropped out of the course. There were 30 on the course. And I remember the director of The Sound of Music saying to me, "Oh, we've got this guy, Kirk Jameson." I said, "Not Kirk Bragg from Mountview." He said, "Well, he's called Kirk Jameson now and he's in the cast." I was like, my goodness. I was like, he dropped out of Mountview.
And while you were there, you performed in Annie Get Your Gun, and you also played Judy Jordan in Carousel.
I did. And do you know what? I thought that was really going to be my moment in drama school. My third year, they give you these shows, took the spotlight. And my biggest success was in a Jerry Herman show. It was a row of songs in it by Jerry Herman. And it's called Jerry's Girls. And it was just like eight girls in a show singing all Jerry Herman classics. And my biggest moment, my biggest showcase in my final year was playing a triangle, because it was funny. And they got a first overall, and I had some sort of accolade at the end of drama school, which was great. I really needed that after 3 years to be recognised as not just another performer, but the best performer in the year. And but I've got to say, all these awards and accolades are all very good, but when you get out in the real world, it's just about resilience and readiness for your performances. So, I mean, it was lovely winning these things and getting these awards and titles, which you remember more about than I do. But all I remember is going to that audition and they would be like, "Next."
Yeah.
and you know, you just have to move on.
But it's interesting what you said before. You used the word graft before. You graduated from the Academy in 2005. And so despite people watching you on TV and thinking you were an overnight success, you worked damn hard to get there, didn't you?
I was in telesales. I'd been out of drama school for a year and a half. I'd worked in Pizza Express. I'd got myself a job in Panto at Milford because the artistic director was so kind. And all those years ago, I'd been in Pirates of Penzance there and he must have remembered me. And so it was all of yourself, self-generating, really. And I heard through a friend that Lloyd Webber had gone on BBC Radio 4 to talk about, on Front Row, to talk about wanting a shop girl to play Maria. And so the girl I sat opposite in telesales said, "Oh, I heard Lloyd Webber on Radio 4. I thought, God, she listens to Radio 4. But she was an actor too. And she said, "Oh, yeah, I might go for it. He wants a shop girl to play Maria." And I thought, oh, I'm basically a shop girl. But I was never losing faith. You know, I was always going for musicals. But I was always the bridesmaid, never the bride, Andrew. And I could just never break through. I had an agent. I had training. I had all these accolades. But nobody looks at your CV. They just look at you. And I wasn't ready until Maria, really. And then I just came into my own.
We'll talk about Maria shortly. Are you an ABBA fan, Connie?
Oh, I love ABBA. Oh, is this... Oh, my gosh. Is this the most melancholy song on earth?
Yeah, I wondered why this one.
Oh, do you know why? Because I've got kids now. So I auditioned for Mamma Mia years ago. And I was always aging up. So I would always be first cover, second cover for somebody in their 30s, even though I was 23, you know, because I was tall. I was probably, you know, size 12, size 14, which is, you know, middling when you go to those kind of castings and you stood next to dancers. And Mamma Mia was always a really enjoyable audition. But I wanted to play Sophie, of course I did. But I was always going for the older songs. So this is one of the songs that they would get me to sing. And now I've got kids, I just really relate to the lyrics. You know, slipping through my fingers all the time. Like my twins are now nearly three. And sometimes I sneak into their room late at night and I just peer into their cots because they're just growing up in front of my eyes and they slip through your fingers. And I, you know, I probably will sing this better than ever because I've got real life experience now.
School bag in hand, she leaves home in the early morning, waving goodbye with an absent-minded smile.
Fifth choice, Connie, I think one of our finest songwriters, and having not heard this... Having not heard this before... I was surprised to find it wasn't from an old West End classic show and that he wrote it himself. So tell us about Gary Barlow and This Is My Time.
Oh, this has everything to do with my children. I got pregnant during COVID. My father had just, I think March the 8th, before lockdown, I think it was on the March 23rd, as I remember. And I was pregnant by June, and I thought, gosh, you know, I'd spent so many years trying to have a baby, and then two come along, and my dad's not around to sort of be a granddad. And anyway, I went through being pregnant during COVID, which is quite good because it's quite relaxing. You know, most people got furloughed from work. I had maternity from work, and it was a desperately sad time for so many people. But I had this kind of this amazing ray of hope and happiness, you know, having lost dad, but then gotten pregnant and this kind of ray of sunshine about to come into my life. Two rays of sunshine coming into my life. And then when I had the babies, I was in hospital for a period of time and I was on my own. And my husband, Jeremy, didn't get to see the girls for, I think, a week. He saw them when they were born and then he didn't get to see them and didn't get to hold his babies. And I selfishly just started listening to songs that I like, and I thought this is my time. I don't know why. I listened to this song. I heard him on some kind of Christmas show. I kind of just Googled it, and something about the lyrics just connected with me. This is my time. Can't even remember the lyrics now, but for some reason, I remember listening to this a heck of a lot on my own for about a week. With my special time with Winnie and Rosie, just me and them in a room in the Heath. And I remember crying my eyes out at times, just feeling so blessed, but also feeling quite lonely, but reminding myself that this is an amazing time.
So should we dedicate this to Winnie and Rosie?
Yeah, well, don't wake them up, please.
Okay.
God.
If love could break you, I'll brace for the pain.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
We are Radio Glamorgan.
Hold tight. Oh, do you know what? I am the sixth size Spice Girl, I swear. Why am I not in the Spice Girls? I've got all the moves.
Yeah.
you should see me.
What Spice would you have been?
Oh, that's a good question. Oh, Singy Spice.
Excellent. Good choice.
Sometimes singy, sometimes a bit zingy. Right now, I look a bit mingy.
So you're a fan of Spice Girls, yeah? I take it.
Am I a fan? This should be a Vodcast, because I had all of the dance moves going on there. And I grew up on a farm in Pembrokeshire singing the Spice Girls, and there was an opportunity in secondary school to do a, what do you call those, an assembly.
Yeah.
And I got all of my friends to be the Spice Girls, and I was posh Spice, of course I was, because I had a bob, because it was cool at the time. And I was probably a bit posher than the others, because my dad was in the army, I sounded a bit posher. And I had a friend who was a gymnast, so she was Sporty Spice, Ginger Spice, well, she sort of ginger, I think. Well, we weren't, you know, exact casting, but we were quite good. And it was a hit. We went from the geeks of the school to the really cool ones for about, well, at least a day. We had cred for being the Spice Girls in assembly. And really, all of these performances, when I look back and cringe, they make you who you are, don't they? They make you performer. So, yeah, singy Spice through and through.
Well, let me tell you, I've never told anyone this, and now lots of people are going to find out.
Go on.
I belonged, this is my claim to fame with the Spice Girls, I belonged to a youth club, and I was one of the leaders, 20-odd years ago now, if not more. And we had a camp for the juniors, for the little ones, hadn't done one before, and we wound them up that the Spice Girls were going to be appearing and doing a song. And basically, it was four of us. And I was Ginger Spice.
Five,
because I was Ginger Spice. I had the Union Jack dress on.
Oh, my Lord. Are there pictures?
No pictures, no videos. No, they've all been destroyed in a fire, unfortunately. Now, Connie.
That's amazing.
In 2006... everything changed for you due to a little Irish comic called Graham Norton, a theatre impresario, Angela Webb, and a BBC series called How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria. You started the story earlier, so let's move on. How did this talent competition come your way?
I was in telesales. I had been out of drama school for a year and a half and heard it on the radio. My friend heard it on the radio, and what happened then? Because the internet didn't really exist. It sort of did, but I can't remember. I think I either rang a number or something like that. But anyway, a pack turned up and I filled it out. And it was a bit old school, this, isn't it? It feels a bit archaic. Mm. But yes, I filled out a form and I had a phone call from a producer saying, you should come, or probably a casting researcher saying, you should come and audition. And I did. I turned up in Cardiff because I thought, you know what? I lived in London at the time. I was still struggling, still going to all the London auditions. And I thought, what I need to do is to get out of London because there'd be less people auditioning. How wrong I was in Cardiff. So I turned up at 5 to 7 in the morning at the Principality Stadium. And I remember the casting producer, the person who is going to be deciding who was going through from this long line of auditions, saying, "Good morning, Connie." And I thought, you know, all those no's in the West End have been worth it just for him to see me in the queue and say, "Morning, Connie." And I think I might have sung Secret Love for this audition. I certainly sang something like Annie Get Your Gun. I can't quite remember, but I sang some crazy songs for these auditions, and they send you from room to room. Go in there, just go and sing in there, go and sing in there, sing again in there. And you're thinking, am I doing okay? Just passed around the shop. And I got to the next stage where you sang with an audience and John Barrowman. And then the next stage, and none of those were for TV. They were just part of the process, and it was brilliant. I absolutely loved it. I loved the pressure. I loved finally having the opportunity to shine and not do telesales anymore. That was the joy of it. And then I got on the live shows, and that was it. That changed my life forever. We were put into a house, a bit like a Big Brother house, with 10 girls who all wanted to play Maria.
You said it's interesting you come to that bit, because you mentioned earlier about not making friends at drama school. Did you make friends with these girls? Because you all wanted to win.
Don't get me wrong, I made friends at drama school. I had some friends from my wedding from drama school. But you're there to learn, you're there to push yourself, and you're always in competition. I think it is hard until you're in a show or on tour to make solid friendships. And often, as we call those are sort of showmances, because you're only together for the time that you're on tour together, or, you know, on the show. So the TV show, I was just there, you know, to do my best. I wasn't even there to win, because I didn't think I would win. But the moment those cameras turned on, I got this bug, and I just thought, I just want to stay here as long as possible. You know, I loved the experience. It was just the best time of my life. But did I make friends? I can't say anyone made friends. I wouldn't say anyone's besties, but I do have a wonderful friend from that experience, Siobhan Dillon, who then had a tough time post-show. She came third. And when I was playing Maria, I said, look, let's go watch a matinee. Let's go watch Grease. And she said, I'm going to write to David Ian and ask for an audition. I said, you do that and I'm going to drop him a text and he's going to have to see you, you know. And so she went to audition for Grease, and that's how her career started, you know. She just needed a confidence boost again. So for everyone who goes on these shows, it doesn't instantly work out. But our friendship, we were bonded through that show, and she was my roomie, you know, and I loved that. So, yeah, I did make a solid friendship from the show. But everyone else was a little bit scratchy.
And the great thing about those shows, and this was proven particularly with the one they did for Oliver, was that you don't have to win it to become a star. The girl's name has escaped me, unfortunately, but the Irish girl in the competition for Oliver, who I think came second, is a big Hollywood actress now and making TV and film dramas. So you get noticed, don't you? That's what those programmes, I think, are about.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a wonderful platform. And I knew that. It would be a wonderful platform whether I'd won or lost. And as I say, every experience makes you a better person, a better performer, a more rounded performer, because you do it for your art. And even after I'd won, I did shows after that where it wasn't glam. You know, I had a rat run over my foot, you know, as I was doing a cross round back to the other side of stage, this was a show after Maria. So I had made it, and I was in a show in a theatre where rats were running over your feet as you do the cross. So it's not a glamorous life. So all of these things shape you. But to have people watching you on your side every week and people voting for you, that was just an incredible privilege. And I look back with such fond memories. You know, it wasn't about making friends. I did make great friends and had a great time. We all had a great time. There's no kind of bitchiness at all during the whole show. It was just everyone wanted to do their best. And it was the first of the kind, you know, it was the first of its kind. Yeah. So no one knew what they were really getting themselves in for. And I think even the production team were like, what have we done? It's such a... But it was one moment when Ronan Keating had to decide. In the pilot, so they did a pilot of the show where we all sang our first songs and Ronan Keating did his performance, which they then used for that live show because he had to rush off. So it was like a dress performance, but they recorded it as live. And Ronan Keating had to be the judge of who won, who was going to win in the show. And he said, Connie. And I was like, oh, my God, he just said my name. Ronan Keating just said my name, everyone. He thinks I'm going to win. So I think that gave me a lot of confidence that on the first show, even Ronan Keating thinks I'm going to win this.
It was a huge belief booster. Can you remember what went through your mind when you were announced as the winner?
I always see that image because I look like some sort of alien. It was like Alien the movie, wasn't it, with my teeth? It was like... What actually went through my mind was, oh, God, I've got to sing again, because I had, at that point, I was exhausted. At that point, I was filled with emotion. You know, my nan was there. My mum was there. I was choked. And then they were like, get ready, you're going to go in 30 seconds. And I was like, I said, I can't sing, I've got no voice. I can't do it anymore. And I was just overcome with emotion. And, yeah, I was just dreading my next performance because it had to be the best ever. And I was exhausted. So, yeah, best time ever. And it was the beginning of a huge roller coaster.
Tell me about Good Thing Going, your seventh choice from Vanessa Williams.
Oh, I love this from Sondheim, by Sondheim or whatever they call it, his kind of personal album. I'm a huge Sondheim fan, and Good Thing Going, do you know, I just love the lyrics of this. I feel this with a lot of kind of things in life, you know. We had a good thing going, gone, because life is like that, isn't it? Mm. You know, you've got to hang on to the things and enjoy the moment. We had a good thing going, gone, and don't let the good things go out of your life. I think so easy to regret things in life, isn't it? And
yeah.
I try to hang on to the good things because they're going.
On November the 15th, 2006, you opened to rave reviews in The Sound of Music. Did you have first night nerves?
Well, we had previews, and during those 10 days of previews, I think I lost two captains. Two captains got fired. There weren't two captains to begin with, but there was a guy from Peak Practice, and he was fired on like the third performance. And then the understudy stepped up and he wasn't right. So Alex Hansen had about 2 days to learn the show. And, you know, he was still reading lines off his hand during the opening night. So it was more about holding his hand through the whole performance than it was being wonderful. And to be honest with you, the director came to my dressing room at the Palladium and he said, "You know what, Connie? Nobody knows the lines but you." I thought, never a truer word spoken. I haven't got fired in the last 10 days, so I must be okay, is what I thought. And Sound of Music had never had good reviews on stage. Difficult to believe, but they'd never had good reviews. So to even contemplate people standing up at the end and giving you, you know, a minute standing ovation or whatever it was, it felt like a lifetime. That was one of the best nights of my life.
And you look back at the whole thing with fond memories. I can hear it in your voice.
Oh, I do. Of course I do. Roller coasters, problems, obstacles, challenges. But, you know, it's in the title, isn't it? How do you solve a problem like Maria?
Yeah.
It was a blessing and a curse.
You ended your run in February 2008, and I have to ask you about the experience 6 months later of the Playing Our Song with Alastair McGowan. And I mentioned this ahead of other stage and TV performances simply because I saw the Tom Conti and Gemma Craven production at the Shaftesbury Theatre in the West End in 1980. I was 13. It was the first time I'd been to the West End, and I loved it.
Tom Conti. I had no idea what I was getting myself in for, but I thought, it's funny. Look, I had the choice of doing cabaret, and I'd gone to see Bill Kenwright, and my agent, who I think was wrong now, said, it's too much for you to go from being a nun and a nanny to stockings and suspenders. It's too much for the audience. They, you know, they won't cope with that. And cabaret, I think they show that they were like naked at the end or whatever. And I was like, I can do that. I can do that. And I loved I loved that production of cabaret in the West End. I think Julian Clary was in it at the time. And he was just so brilliant. I just wanted to be in cabaret. But there was this other opportunity. And my agent, who I was listening to, said, well, Judy Gench has just played the Menier, so you should play the Menier Chocolate Factory. And I thought, it's got chocolate in the title of the theatre. I need to be there. So I played the Menier Chocolate Factory. And it was for a short run with a comedian. And it turned out to be Alastair McGowan. And what a gorgeous man. What a delight, you know. He was just the most amazing, you know, he always felt, I think, in the shadow of Tom Conti, but what an incredible performer. And I had the best time in there playing our song. And during that time, I met my husband, and he watched that show a lot, and he loved it. He loved it a lot more than The Sound of Music, might I add.
Right. It's a lovely show, though, isn't it? It's an underrated show as well, I think.
Yeah, again, it's just filled with emotion, kind of 70s vibes, you know. I can't really remember any of the songs.
No, nor me, but I just remember enjoying it.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that washes over you and you think, oh, watch that again. It was basically a two-hander with a few cast. It just had a lovely cast, massive part, massive sing, and it was funny, and I like being funny. So I had the best time. And in hindsight, I was glad I didn't do cabaret, and I was glad I didn't get naked.
And your husband-to-be was probably glad you didn't get naked in front of all those people.
I wouldn't have been. Yes, I'm sure he was.
On air, all day, every day. Broadcasting from the largest hospital in Wales. We are Radio Glamorgan.
My guest on this edition of Music Was My First Love is Connie Fisher, and if you want to listen to any of the previous episodes of the series, which are rapidly approaching the 100 mark, then once this series is over, they're repeated randomly every Monday, Wednesday and Friday at 10 p.m. and there's also the podcast. Just go to your platform and search for Mini Music Was My First Love. Right, Connie, let's hear about your eighth choice, and you've chosen something from Sarah Bareilles.
I love this song. It's about gravity, isn't it? Something always pulls me back to you. I just love it. Just love that lyric. Sarah Bareilles has just the most incredible voice. And again, full of emotion. And you can hear that she's written this song about being in a relationship or being perhaps an addiction. And if you have any kind of any gravitational pull towards something, hopefully you'll relate to this song. I certainly do. I've got loads of things. I've got a bit of an addictive personality. So if I want to do something, I really want to do it, you know, whether it comes to running or singing or whatever it is, I want to do it with all of my heart. And when you become so tunnel visioned, it can trip you up. And the lyrics of this song, I love it, and I love her, and I love her voice. Oh, Andrew, I love it. I love it. Isn't it? It's just like anyone who's been in a relationship or can't get out of it, or they're just drawn to something. It's just, oh man, it's like therapy, this, isn't it?
Yeah. Now I joked about it earlier, but I can hear you singing along to some of these songs, and particularly that one. So it's very strange that we move on to the next subject. And when did you first realise that there was some kind of problem with your voice?
Well, it was smack bang in the middle of the Palladium. I had a cold, and I'm not going to lie, I basically got shoved on stage by the Lord and the team. And, you know, get on there, you know, everyone does it. I've sung a lot when you've had a cold, you know, but I took some ibuprofen, and that can raise the blood vessels in your cords, which I didn't realise, and I had a vocal hemorrhage, and suddenly my clean kind of crystalline voice was really quite fluffy, and it was like singing through a cloud. I didn't know what had gone wrong. Something had happened during this performance, and I thought it was just because I had a cold, or what was going on, was I hearing something wrong? Anyway, Leslie Garrett said, I think you've had a vocal hemorrhage. We need to get you to a voice doctor. And the next day I was in Harley Street, and they said, you've had a vocal hemorrhage. It's okay. You need some time off. I wasn't given a lot of time off, you know, not as much as I would have liked, because everyone had paid to see the girl off the telly, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was only ever supposed to do two shows a week, and suddenly I was doing eight shows a week. Probably getting paid for two. I didn't really care. I just was happy to be Maria, you know. It just went downhill from there. I didn't recover well. It was just all really bad. It was a really very dark time, and I had to rehabilitate my voice, and I had to learn to sing again, essentially. And then when I left, I don't know what happened, but they did some more tests because there was a creak in my voice, and I'd never had any form of creak. And they said, oh, it's acid reflux. You're having too much tomato, and you're having, you know, whatever, it, you know, they thought I was having. And they did some investigations under anaesthetic, and they said it's something that you must have been born with. You've got this kind of holes in each of your cords. This isn't something that has happened. This is something that has always been there. But these holes in the cords will get bigger over time. And the trouble with vocal cords is they need to vibrate. So if there's a hole in them, packing up with gunk, they're not going to vibrate very well. So the creak was caused by the stiffness and the lack of vibration. And that was just going to get worse from there. So I went to America. I had some operations, and they said, basically, we can fix one side, but you'll never sing again. And I said, I will sing again. And I did. I rehabilitated my voice. And he said, it's incredible, Connie, what the brain can do. You've lived with this condition your whole life. You've sung around it. I always thought I had some kind of extraordinary vocal thing going on. But actually, it was just my voice was different. My setup was different. And I wouldn't have known it unless I was a singer. And sadly, I wouldn't have had that downfall and that obstacle then if I hadn't have been a singer. So, I had some operations. They couldn't fix it. And I've sung around it ever since.
Just to jump back a bit, being told that you'd never sing again, was it the positive attitude you just said, or was it like a knife through the heart?
Of course, whenever you get bad news, you know, so many people will be listening to this that have had that moment, and you think there's two ways to deal with this, aren't there? You fight or flight. I could have just run away and said, that's it, I'm never going to do it again. But I was like, I'm going to be Maria again. I'm going to sing again. And what I've always realised is that singing isn't about being the perfect singer. It is about singing from the heart. And this just gave me more emotion to sing with and more heart to sing with because I wanted it. So I've always sung from the heart, and more than ever, when I went back on stage, I had to lower everything by a tone, which is quite a lot as a singer. I'm sure the musical director hated me because everything had to come down. I think they even had two scores where I could take it down another notch, just depending on how I was feeling that night. So suddenly Maria wasn't a crystalline soprano, she was a bit of an alto. So most nights I was a mezzo, and I sang from the heart. And I stood on the hill and we made magic again. And that's all that matters, isn't it? You sing from the heart. And do you know what? Even when I came back after those vocal operations, no one ever said to me, you don't sound like you. To them, I sounded just as I did, even though it was 100 times more effort. Everyone was very positive, and I went along with that positivity for as long as I could.
And then a man came into your life called Gary Katona.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was weird, I have to say, yeah. I sort of moved on. I decided a few years later to go into TV. It sort of fell into TV. I'd gotten married, settled down here in Wales, living in Barry, and I was working with a TV company to develop ideas. And weirdly, I'd heard about this guy called Gary Katona. Literally overheard someone talking about him. It's like somebody was stood there and I was meant to hear it. And I've always been a great believer in fate, but I often think that was set up. Because I wasn't supposed to be in this place at this time. So how on earth could that have happened? Anyway, I heard about this guy, and he just took on the challenge of trying to help me sing once more. So I'd gone on tour at that point, and I'd walked away from the profession. The curtain was down for me. But I wanted to sing once more because it's like it's a muscle, isn't it? It's going to the gym. And if you don't use it, you lose it. So he had quite a radical gym to go to, a hardcore gym of singing. I can't say that was something I would endorse. He was great. He was everything I needed at the time to be positive about it. And I did. I sang once more. That was it, really. Gary Katona. You got to watch it. You got to Google him. He's mad.
I've seen bits of the documentary, and I've seen your performance that you gave at the end. Is singing professionally night after night a thing of the past now for you?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Like, thing of decades ago. Yeah.
But is that,
my kids. We sing, you know.
Is that because of the voice or because you've moved on?
Both. Yeah. I think Stamina-wise, the problem with my voice now is that it won't recover in time for the next performance. So an 8-show week is definitely not a thing. Mm. A 2-show week, maybe I could have done it, but really it's about family now.
Yeah.
And moving on mentally, I needed to get a second career. So I knew I needed to start. If you're a weak link in a cast, you are like the runt of the litter. You are. And, you know, any eagles can just swoop and, you know, take you. Honestly, it is like if you're a chink in that armour, it's not great. It's not a great feeling for that performer. So I didn't want to be that weak link anymore. And so I moved on mentally in about 2013. I started a new career in TV. And the Gary Katona experience of singing once more really came like 2015 or something. It was really over for me then anyway. I was never going to go back to theatre. Mm. Even though I had lots of lovely offers, I would love to play Anna in The King and I, of course I would. But I can't do it 8 shows a week, and I wouldn't want people to be disappointed. Coming to see the girl that they saw on the telly, and she was only doing 2 shows a week. So I'm not in the profession of letting people down.
And the situation with your voice not being able to recover, would you not be able to do a play 8 shows a week either, do you think?
Maybe, but for me, I studied musical theatre, and music is what I want to do.
Yeah.
But vocally, plays are just as demanding. Yeah. You know, you are projecting every night. I did a show with Siri McKellen once. It was just a little variety thing. It was actually a tribute to Stephen Gately.
Right, yeah.
And we were all doing a little turn in memory of Stephen, and Ian McKellen took the microphone aside and was like, I'm going to do this speech. I thought, that's a real actor, isn't it? Yeah. He can really project. And you've really got the same setup. You know, actors aren't lazy musical theatre performers. They just have equally a brilliant vocal stamina and need to look after their voices too. So, do you know what? But I couldn't be less than I wanted to be, you know, not less than, but I couldn't think differently. I had to be in musicals because music was part of my DNA. So it was, let's move on. As Sondheim would say, you have to move on. And here I am in a totally different profession with a wonderful family, living my own musical every day.
Now, I host a show on Radio Glamorgan on a late night Saturday. It's all about the music, not about me. And about a month ago, you sent me through your list of songs, and listening to them and putting the show together, your penultimate choice I played a couple of weeks ago because it stood out to me for some reason. Tell me about Sigrid and a track called Dynamite.
Oh, such a good song. Now I'm feeling that all my songs are a bit samey, Andrew. I'm so sorry.
No, don't apologise.
They're all quite hearty, aren't they? They're full of emotion. But Dynamite, I think this is a good time to play this song because, you know, you think you're strong, but I'm dynamite, okay? You think, if you've been through a breakup or something like that, this is a song to listen to because, or you've been in a difficult relationship. I can't say that I have, but, you know, in life you have these situations, don't you? And I feel like in any given situation you can relate to this song. You think you're what are the lyrics? You think you're you think you're really tough, but actually I can blow you up because I have the power. And I like that. I like Sigrid's vulnerability as a performer, and I think every great performer that I love listening to has a vulnerability, and I think she has that in bucket loads. So that's why I love Dynamite, because it's an incredibly powerful song from such a vulnerable performer.
Oh, I wish we had a common view. You see, my red is blue. Oh, I don't belong in your universe.
I just feel stronger listening to her.
I can tell why. Yeah.
You think you're safe, safe as a mountain, but I'm dynamite. So watch out for me. That's the way I take it. I just, even if you have a disagreement over Christmas, you know, with one of your family, you've got one of those family feuds going on, you think you're safe as a mountain, but know that I'm dynamite. I'm explosive.
Absolutely right. Listen, one of the annoying things about this programme is that I only have a certain amount of links to talk about things. So I'm going to cram a few things into this last one. Tell me about the Connie Fisher Academy.
Oh, that was a privilege to set up a little academy, I think over 2 summers, I think, that we ran the academy. It is what you'd imagine it is. It's a young person's academy for musical theatre. I had the best of the best teaching, the best of the West End, and the best of the West End of Barry. That's me. It was a beautiful privilege to put that together and had some amazing students. So Callum Scott Howells, who was in It's a Sin, was part of my academy, and Jodie Bird, who has gone on to great things in the West End. And I just feel like I was just, you know, very lucky to be that sort of magnet of musical theatre to so many young people who wanted to pursue that dream. And I'm so, you know, happy that we did that. I wish I could do it more, actually, but, you know, I felt that I needed to move on with a different career, and so I put that to rest. Maybe one day we'll do some. I do loads of workshops, and I teach privately with performers who like to sing and like to compete, actually, because I feel I've got a lot of experience in that area. So I still teach and I still do workshops. But the academy, they had 2 stints, and I absolutely loved every second of it.
But although it was only 2 stints. It, especially for the 2 people that you named, a great legacy of your musical career.
Just a privilege, you know, it is a privilege to have an academy, the Connie Fisher Academy. I was kind of embarrassed when they called it that, but, and I say they, it was a guy from Barry who runs a kids' musical theatre Saturday group, and he said, we should do something. What, you're wasted just sat here. And I thought, you know what, yeah, we could do this, this and this. He was like, yeah, great. And he was such a great producer and organiser that he made it happen. And yeah, I'm just very, very grateful to Christian for making it happen, because I got so much from it, you know. It wasn't like a headmistress thing, but it wasn't a power thing, but it just felt like I'm giving so much knowledge to young people who want to go through this, and honestly giving it as well, not making it out to be a fluffy cloud of a dream. It is a hard road that you have to pave yourself, but you've got to enjoy every moment of it. If you don't love music, don't bother, just give up now. And none of them did, I have to say. All of them still get in touch with me and say, I'm still doing it, I'm still performing, still competing, I'm still living my dream.
How did you get involved with Noah's Ark?
I got involved with Noah's Ark when I was 12.
Oh, okay.
A lady from Pembrokeshire. Yeah, weird. It was sort of really, really young. I was in Pembrokeshire. I was the girl who'd won the Pill Social Centre's Milford Haven cabaret singing thing. Oh, my friends and I still look back and laugh at the Pill Social Centre moment, because I was out of my depth. You know, everyone was so adult and I was some sort of, I don't know, young person. I just won this talent show, and a lady probably read it in the paper, and she said something like, do you want to sing this song called Through the Eyes of a Child? I mean, it was an okay song. It was fine. But I thought, this is a journey. This is, sounds like fun. Yeah, why not? Hey, I'm probably a bit older than that, actually. It was probably about, 15. It was probably 15, something like that. Definitely wasn't 12. But, I sang this song, and then I remember singing in Cardiff for Catherine Zeta-Jones. But Charlotte Church was also singing that night. And as I got up on stage, they thought I was Charlotte Church and they started playing her track. So I was suddenly about to sing Ave Maria, which is kind of ironic now. It was weird, a weird experience. So I sang Through the Eyes of a Child. It'll never see the light of day. It was, hopefully, you're not going to play that next, are you?
No.
But take a look at the world through the eyes of a child. Go something like that. It's terrible, terrible song. But you know what? It raised some money for Noah's Ark. And that was my beginning of my my charity fundraising. Now, they don't remember that until I won Maria, and they were like, oh, this girl's from Wales. And I said, I already know you. I've done stuff for you. Let's do stuff together. And I just, you know, love, you know, inspiring kids and being there for kids. And now working in TV, I work with a lot of celebrities, and I feel that there's an opportunity for kids to meet amazing celebrities. I'll make that happen. So I took Catherine Jenkins there when I was doing Catherine Jenkins's Christmas show. I was producing that for the BBC in my new career as a TV person. And I took Catherine there as part of it. And I took the Hoff when I was making a documentary with the Hoff. So yeah, I feel like in some way being Connie in this very normal job as a TV producer, you know, I'm not really a TV producer, I'm behind the scenes, so I'm a development producer. So I come up with the ideas and then make it happen. But in many respects, being Connie Fisher helps to facilitate great things sometimes. Mm. And I took the Hoff there and took Catherine there, and I think it made a lot of kids very happy and inspired so many. And really, at the end of the day, when you're privileged enough to be someone like me who's won a show, then it's all about inspiring the next generation and hoping that they will enjoy it as much as you do. That was a long answer, wasn't it? Sorry.
There's been a lot of acting work for you, not just singing. You had a role in Casualty. You've fronted programmes such as Songs of Praise. But the reason, as we touched on at the beginning of this, that I was able to make contact with you was through Jamie Balch, who was in this series early in the year, and you were involved in the documentary industry, Searching for His Birth Mom. So how did you get into TV production with Ventimedia?
Do you know, I was doing a documentary about me and about being a twin. I lost my twin when I was a baby. And so I was doing this very personal, heartfelt documentary for S4C in Welsh. And so I was talent on a show. And the owner of the company said, we're pitching Channel 4 next week. You haven't got any ideas. Now, being an actor, being a musical theatre actor, you spend a lot of time watching daytime TV. And you think, this is rubbish. I shouldn't say that, really. But basically, I'd come up with a couple of ideas for Channel 4 daytime. And just in conversation with them, really. They were really creative people. And I said, I've got some thoughts, some ideas. They pitched those ideas, and one of them got commissioned as a pilot. I then started working with the TV company. And I decided what I really need in my new profession. This was maybe 2 years in to that role as a development researcher, essentially, and a development person. I come up with ideas, and so that was my job. And I thought, what I really need to solidify my name in this new career and for people to stop thinking that I'm going to go back to theatre is to win a BAFTA. And so I was at a dinner party where Jamie Balch was, and he happened to mention that he was adopted. And I was like, I never knew that about you. And he said, oh, I don't really talk about it much, but I'm 40 next year. And I said, wow, that's a, you know, amazing at 40, you've never looked back. Have you ever thought to find your biological mum? He said, no. I said, well, I plied him with wine and I said, how about it? How about we go on the journey to find your birth mum? And long story short, he said he did find his birth mum. Mm-hmm. And sadly, she had terminal cancer. And the story itself was just an incredible story to be a part of and capture. So I ended up working on that production, not just coming up and pitching the idea, but working on it with him and holding his hand through it. And it was just hugely emotional. And you know, the documentary won a BAFTA. And that really changed my life entirely, because it gave me an opportunity to grow as in TV production and to believe in myself as a person who can come up with ideas and win commissions for TV, which is now what I do every single day.
You're enjoying it.
I love it. I love it. It's varied. And you know what? It's exactly like meeting Jamie. You meet people and you think, this person's amazing. They've got an amazing story. I've got to tell this story. And it's always really a present tense story. In my case, it often involves celebrities who've got an incredible journey. And what's important and what I feel connects me to that is that I have, for a very brief period of my life, been a celebrity and have had that fame. And I can appreciate what it's like to expose part of you on a very personal level. And I feel that That's what I'm destined to do, is to tell stories for a living.
We've heard a lot of female voices tonight, and with the greatest respect to Carole King and Doris Day and Vanessa Williams and the others, we've saved the best for last. Was Dame Shirley Bassey a big influence on you and a big inspiration?
You know, she was, yeah. Just an incredible singer, just an incredible voice. So absolutely loved listening to Shirley Bassey, you know. The powerhouse, you know, It used to be Whitney, but I think then as I've gotten older, I've listened to the greats, and the great is Bassey.
Yeah. Any reason for this particular song? Because it is?
Because it is, yeah. Because listen to it. You can't help but feel empowered.
The moment that Graham Norton announced you as the winner of How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria, your life was certainly never going to be the same again. You've had a busy 17 years since then, mostly full of successes, but a lot of downs also. We spoke earlier about the loss of your voice. So looking back, Connie, is there one thing in your career that you're most proud of?
Keeping calm and carrying on, I think, is what I'm most proud of. And also my kids. Who wouldn't say that? Carrying on in the face of adversity is everything. And life is sent to try you.
And final question, as we sit here recording this in November 2023, you have the twins who it's quite moving listening to you mentioning them a lot. They must be running around the bend, I'm sure, but professionally, what's the immediate future? Is it developing TV documentaries?
Yeah, head of development. I write ideas with my team, pitch them, and you'll see my name in the end of the credits. That's where you'll see me now. But it's a kind of a silent bow I take at the end of every show.
Connie, it's been a genuine delight. It really has. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew. I've loved every single song.
You're listening to Music Was My First Love on Radio Glamorgan, where Connie Fisher has been choosing 10 of her favourite tracks. My name is Andrew Wolfe, and join me again very soon when I'll be joined by another guest who will choose 10 of their favourite tracks on another edition of Radio Glamorgan's award-winning series, Music Was My First Love. Music of the Past.